All right, now these two little letters are the smallest two letters in the New Testament. Both of them are smaller than the other one chapter books. Anybody remember what the other one chapter books are in the New Testament? Jude is one. Philemon is the other one, all right? And both of these are smaller than either of those two. Both of these in the original language have less than 300 words, which you can envision them being maybe written on one sheet of papyrus, which was the plant-based writing material of the time, the cheapest kind of writing material for the time. And both of them, as you can tell by the names, have traditionally been linked to the first letter, hence 2nd and 3rd John. And the interesting thing is, if you start comparing the outward details, at least, of these two letters, it may be helpful for us in kind of putting them in context. Please notice that in both of these letters, they are... You know, in New Testament letters, the contrast to English letters, the way we write, we put dear somebody and then we sign our name at the end. They start with the name of the writer. And in this case, both of them are simply said to be from the elder. Notice verse 1 of 2nd John, and then also in 3rd John, the first two words in English versions are again the elder. So this leads to the question of the identity of this writer. Is this the Apostle John, or is this a separate person to be thought of as John the Elder? And it's interesting that in more recent times there's been more of a tendency to identify the writer as a separate John the Elder. I'm always a little bit cautious in my approach whenever I find out that the popularity of this theory is almost totally in recent times. I always wonder why we think we're in a better spot to identify who the writer was than the people who were closest to the time. The theory that this is a separate John the Elder, as far as I can find out, is largely based on a writing of one of the early church fathers, a man named Papias, who had a list of some of the apostles, the witnesses of the Lord and his teaching and his work, in which he named John twice. Papias is thought to, is regarded as a church father who was not maybe as careful a writer always, not as skilled a writer as some of the others would have been. And so this, the whole debate about this is, it seems to me like it originates from that. Otherwise, almost the unanimous view from early on with the so-called church fathers, and we're talking about people who go back to just after the first century now, the ones who would have been the generation following the apostles, regarded and quoted from especially 2nd John and attached it to the Apostle John. The reading of these letters by, especially if we were reading in the original, we would notice writing styles and phraseology which had much in common with 1 John and the Gospel of John. So, and I'll call your attention to some of the phrases in just a minute, but the style would indicate as well what tradition assumed, and that is that this is from the Apostle John. That's how I am going to take it as we go through this. Now, one of the questions would be a characteristic of John's writings, especially in the gospel. He never names himself. How does John refer to himself in the gospel of John? Talking about the Apostle John now. How does he refer to himself in the Apostle of John? Or the epistle, the gospel of John. Say it right. All right, the disciple whom Jesus loved. He always refers to himself in that way. And in that circumstance, he would be identifying himself among the other apostles. Now, when he refers to himself as the elder, what might be the purpose of identifying himself in that way?
Authority.
That's a possibility, a way of illustrating his authority, his right to speak, which, by the way, he writes identifying himself just that way. How would the reader know whether this was John or me or Barney?
Was he choosing to be an elder?
Some think he might have been an elder. Peter was described himself as being a fellow elder in 1 Peter 5. Could mean he's just an older man. And how would he be able to refer to himself that way and people know who he's talking about?
Well, he's talking to people that knew about what he was talking
about. All right, someone who knew of him and of his right to speak and of his authority. In 1 John, John refers to himself as an eyewitness and as someone who has authority to speak. Eyewitness in 1 John 1 and the authority to be heard in 1 John 4. And now as the elder in that way. So that's how we're going to approach this. Now, in 2 John, notice this is written to the elect lady, it says. And in 3 John, notice that it is the beloved Gaius, who is the recipient of the letter. Now, with Gaius, it's pretty easy to see we're talking about an individual who is being addressed by Paul and or by John and is being advised about how to handle a particular problem. In our letter that we begin today, the elect lady, is this a person or is it a congregation who is referred to this way? In the book of Revelation, which is also John's writing, he addresses church. He addresses the seven stars who are the messengers of the seven churches, and he pictures the Lord's people as a woman or a lady in it. So it may be, and this has been the traditional way of taking this, that this is a congregation. And this is an individual. That this is a personification and this is a person. And the reason for that is in this letter, John will move from the second person singular, you, in the middle of the letter, which is its message, to the second person plural, you. In Arkansas, you guys. And so this is the idea that we're talking more about or to a group of people here and to an individual here. It's interesting that in more recent times, a lot of people believe, a lot of the writers will get fascinated with the idea that this is an individual woman. In the original language, it's like this. And this, in the original language, this epsilon would sound like an A. And then the other word is like this. This is an R, by the way, Korea. And so people will take it, you'll find it capitalized like this, as if it's an individual. Electa Kyria. And the word for sir or lord in Greek is this, kurios. And so this would be the feminine form, and this would be a name which means lady. And so you take it that way. But notice it has to be adapted some. This is the word for chosen, the chosen feminine, and then the lady. So anyway, that's more we need to know probably about it. But it's interesting the kind of stuff people get fascinated with. I take this as being written to a congregation and dealing with a particular problem in that way. So that would be one comparison. The other couple other things we'll mention. They use similar terminology, and especially words like love and truth, especially. Now, and that will, you'll notice love and the truth will come up repeatedly, even in the first part of this letter we're about to read. And the truth, for example, 9 times in 1 John, and then 11 times in these two little letters. And then love becomes, so I believe we're dealing with the same problem or different aspects of the same problem that we're dealing with in 1 John. In 1 John, you remember these people who come along trying to undermine the confidence of Christians, claiming that they have more initiated or higher knowledge in which they are able to discern that Jesus only was a man in the flesh, but he was only Christ in the flesh in between his baptism and right before he died and that kind of thing. Otherwise, he was just a man who seemed to be God during that period of time. And John battles that and all its implications here. And then if people thought that you could hold to that theory about Christ and it not have any moral claim on your life, your everyday behavior, or on your relationships and how you treated your brothers and sisters in the Lord, then that would be a big part of the issue. There is a similar message in both of these. And I think I can do it this way. If you compare verses 7 in these two letters and think about the instruction contained in it, then you can see a way to contrast them. So look at verse 7 of 2 John to start with. Carrie, read that for me, please.
For many deceivers have gone out into the world, those who do not confess the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. Such a one is the deceiver and the antichrist.
All right. Now, you got to remember that in 1 John, chapter 2 and verse 18, John said there are many antichrists have gone out into the world. And now he says the deceiver and the antichrist is the one who does not confess the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. The big debates that start out in the commentary. Well, in 1 John, antichrist was plural, and in 2 John, it's singular. Therefore, it's a different writer, but I think he's dealing with the same problem. Doesn't it look that way to you? Look at 3 John verse 7 now. A little bit different situation. Look what it says. This gets you started with what I'm getting at. It's not the main idea, but at the end of verse 6, it's talking about the people going, you sending them on their journey. And verse 7, for they have gone out for the sake of the name, accepting nothing from the pagans. I'll paraphrase a bit. And the idea, if you contrast those two deals, in this one, you don't, in this one, there are people coming along that you don't endorse and you don't help and you don't support. And in this one over here, there are people come along with the message that you do help and you do support and you do care for. And in both cases, what is at stake now is the truth and how it got spread in those days, and what a church or an individual Christian's obligation was in those different situations. Now, that leads us to maybe the practice that is in the background of both of these. The practice of hospitality. We would say not having people over as we would do it now, but I'm going to use this idea, the same practice over here. Not the what we mean by hospitality in which I have you over, but the way in which the gospel message got to be spread in that first century world. Can anyone describe to me how was the Roman world, especially the right time for God to send his son and for the message to be carried over the whole world at that time? What advantages did the Roman world offer for that, for the spread of the gospel? All right, especially the Roman roads. We were, Kay called me in and showed me a deal the other night on public TV about this guy. What's the guy's name that travels all these different places? He was in a place where he was showing the Ignatian Way, the Roman road, and all of the part of it that's still there and so forth. These roads, they were maintained by the Roman legions, and they were protected also in that same way, and therefore individuals could travel safely to all these different places, which was a new thing at the time. What else suited it especially to be the right time?
Basically one government
in the whole world. All right, one government. So they were able, it was all the empire, and all under the control of the emperor, and all under the penalty of being answerable to the Roman army. And that meant that you didn't have to stop at the state line or something. You could go from one place to another. And therefore, the mission of the church could be fulfilled. There's a couple of other key issues. Can you tell me another thing?
Travels went faster. The news were traveling faster.
All right. The news could travel faster. You're getting close to what I have in mind. One other key issue.
Common culture.
All right. At least
put everything in a new context.
All right. So there are different cultural settings, like background of Jewish or Greek or Roman, but the Roman prevails right now. You're getting close to the one key thing. What? Language. Even though they each would have their own language or dialect also, there was a common language for writing and communicating that would be understood and usable everywhere. What was it? What language is the New Testament written in?
Greek.
A kind of Greek, Koine Greek, or common Greek. Common, that language made it possible to communicate. All right, those are all advantages. There was, however, one huge disadvantage. What was it? Can you think of one? What do you do when you're about to travel for more than one day somewhere? What? You book a hotel, a place to stay. Were there, my favorite, in my budget, Motel 6s in Rome? Or Red Roof Inn? No. That's the problem. There were no, say it this way, not only safe, but also respectable places to stay. One of the noticeable things I see in the commentaries about these, or the stuff that I can find, is the inns of the time had a very widespread reputation for being immoral and unhealthy and often dangerous places. The inns and innkeepers were associated with a lot of the lowest things in life. They were houses of ill repute very often, and they were not places godly people would want to seek out as a base of operation in a place where they might take the gospel. So, what were the Lord's servants? How was this managed when a teacher or someone went from one place to another to carry the gospel or to teach those interested in it more deeply over a longer time? How did they resolve the problem?
Put enough for that period of time that they were in.
Who would?
All right.
So you didn't travel with a tent or an RV or something. You went and some kind or godly person in that town would stay there. And if you look at Paul's work in the book of Acts, you know this is noticeable. Can you think of anybody that he stayed with? Aquila and Priscilla. And he worked with them. That would be one great example. There was a man named Gaius at Corinth that Paul apparently stayed with. There were other individuals. When Jesus sent out his disciples on the limited commission in Luke 12, remember Luke 10, excuse me, he Matthew 10, so I'm trying. He told them that they would go and then there would be some noble person in these places he would send them for them to stay with. All right, now that's the practice. Can you see any way in which that practice might be open to abuse? Can you see any challenges in that practice? If you are a faithful Christian who is loyal to the truth, what challenge, and in a place where someone comes to, what challenge does that bring? And if you are someone, we'll say, who has not completely wholesome motives, and you travel from one place to another like this in that time, is there any possible abuse, means of abuse that you notice?
Sure, you would go into their homes and teach false teaching.
All right. It might be that you would find that you would be someone who has no intention of being held accountable to the truth, but you see free room, free board, and a possible following, and you can easily go from one place and and use people, if I could say it that way, in a manner which was not wholesome or noble, right? Now, if you're the individual who lives in the place and you are a loving, big-hearted person who wants to be supportive of the Lord's work, what kind of problem does that put, what kind of challenge does that place before you?
By you allowing them to stay there, you're basically condoning what they're doing.
All right. Do I just accept and put up anybody who comes along and claims to be, have some news from Christ?
I think you would learn not to.
All right. There might be someone who would say, I told you this story before, but I remember so well sitting in my study at Green Forest, Arkansas, one Saturday afternoon, and someone came to my door. We didn't keep the building locked back in those days. They just came and the guy walked into my room there, and he introduced himself as the Apostle George. I'm serious, he did. And he had me come outside with him. He had a brand new 24-foot Winnebago. And he said the Lord had sent him from somewhere in Iowa to Newton County, Arkansas, to establish a retreat for people to go, for Christians to go to when the Great Tribulation came. And the Lord had told him to stop all along the way, and any righteous man would fill that up with gas for him. Now, so that is a sort of a challenge. Not everybody would be that out in the open with it. I turned out to be unrighteous that day, by the way. Because I believe that you could identify, the truth was something you could identify.
One place we're told to examine the spirit.
All right. And in fact, this is the same writer, Carl, in 1 John 4 is exactly where Carl is talking about. And we're given the responsibility to examine this and what we're listening to.
Yes. It is curious that also in 2 Thessalonians, Paul warns people on 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 11 and 12, for we hear that some among you are living a dissipated life, doing no work at all, but acting like busybodies. Not such person we command and exhort to the Lord Jesus Christ to work in quiet fashion and eat their own bread. It's his own beginning. I mean, Paul is already giving the same warning that John gives in the article.
A similar problem with a possible difference that in this case, he's talking also about what they taught.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so what's going to happen then in these letters is this one to the church, Paul's going to say, or John's going to say, you guys are in for a long couple months here if I keep using the wrong name. John's going to say, in this case, if someone comes along and you can see that it's not the truth, then don't receive him. Don't support him. Don't be used by
him. And how would you apply that? Like, would you visit with them before you invited them into your home? Because in 2 John, it's in... I'm getting ahead of you, probably.
Yes, you are a little bit.
In verse 10, it says if he doesn't hold this doctrine, don't have him into your home for greeting.
Yeah. You got to remember, he's talking about confessing that Jesus Christ has come in flesh. You're talking about the central Christian confession. If someone does not uphold that, then don't. Said Louis.
Did that happen to me this time? I went to Mexico, talking to my family about this specific verse. And they believe that you should cut those people completely. I said, no, that's not what he's saying.
Right.
how is these people going to receive the good news unless you actually keep the proclamation to bring it to yourself and talk to them? Not to receive the doctrine as a different whole thing.
Right. So so this is a place where John doesn't mean to be mean to them. And this is a place where I'm trying to point out the balance that's necessary here. The balance. So I read somewhere, it put this way. Our love needs to be hardened by the truth. Our truth needs to be softened by love. Remember, Paul says it a different way in Ephesians 4, speaking the truth in love. And so that's the idea. So on the other part of this, he's writing to Gaius, and there's somebody at play in this letter whose name is Diotrephes. And he is taking this to an extreme where he's putting himself sort of as the arbiter, and he's saying nobody who comes along should be received and helped. And so 3 John is going to tell us if somebody comes along and he brings the truth, then he should be recognized and accepted and heard and encouraged. So if you put these three letters in order, 1 John gave us some ways in which we can know that someone is walking in the light. Remember the three tests? Does this person morally live like Jesus? Does this person socially accommodate or act in love toward his brothers? Does this person doctrinally hold to the truth that Jesus Christ is the Son of God come in the flesh? This letter says if someone comes along and doesn't pass that test, don't help him. This letter says if someone comes along and does pass that test, help him. Be his partner. Have fellowship with him. So 1 John is applied to the individual life. 2 John is applied to the false teacher. 3 John is applied to the faithful brother. And in that way, all three of them together offer a balanced picture of faithful Christian living. And it's helpful in that way in a world where there are so many contradictory ideas and challenges to the faith. All right. Hopefully that will serve as an introduction to these two letters. I'll not go back and repeat this when we get to 3 John. Be aware of that. But I want for us to start with the sense of balance. 1 John, individual assurance. 2 John applied to the false teacher. 3 John applied to the faithful brother. And in that way, we can be healthy and whole without trying to withdraw to ourselves and being being judges of all things that way. All right, today, you need to go up and get a drink, then make a left turn and come back to the multi-purpose room where we're going to be meeting this morning. Thank you guys much for being with us. We wish all of you guys, Gretchen, Alice, others of you, Andy, Kirsten, Carrie, you guys who are in the educational field, we hope a good year for you guys. Safe travels to the ones who will be traveling, and better health to the ones whose children need to get well, Mike. Thank you guys very much for being with us today.